Welcome to Inspired Money, the live stream podcast featuring inspiring money stories and inspiring lifestyles. Together, we'll learn to make more, give more, and live more. For an interactive experience, join us live at youtube.com/inspiredmoney. Inspired Money is co-created by Runnymede Capital Management and Eagles Vision Creative Collaborative Media Design. We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Aloha, Inspired Money Makers. If you're here for the first time, welcome. If you're returning, welcome back to another episode of Inspired Money, the live stream podcast where we feature a panel of experts to help us make the most of our money. I'm your host, Andy Wong, financial advisor, here to guide you on today's topic, sustainable investing, making an impact with your portfolio. Before we jump into it, I want to share a quick update about a really funny event that I hosted last week, Thursday, on July 25th. I promoted the Ukulele Masters concert in my hometown, featuring the incredibly talented Herb Ota Jr. and Brian Tolentino. We had a good turnout, and it was a fantastic evening of music for my community. It was a family event, as usual. My wife was working the door collecting tickets. My son helped to load in and load out equipment. And my eldest daughter ran the sound during the show. My youngest was at camp. And it was really cool in several ways. Not only did we enjoy great music, but we raised money for St. Paul's Episcopal Church. A big lesson that I learned is that hosting a concert in the summer is not that good for sales. Too many people were away. But the good news is that the money raised will cycle through and help more people through the church's outreach programs. The church donates funds and sends volunteers to organizations like Family Promise, which prevents and ends homelessness for families and children. The Interfaith Food Pantry. Last year, the organization distributed over 2 million pounds of food and provided 1.9 million meals in my county here in New Jersey. And North Porch provides critical supplies for babies and toddlers in New Jersey. These are just a few examples. One more, Crossroads Camp and Retreat Center. That's where my youngest daughter was at camp. And personally, it was a dream come true for me, right? Because I got to hang out with two ukulele musicians that I look up to. And I love that the evening checked off multiple boxes for me and my family, community, culture, and cause. And just like the concert, had several layers of benefits. I see sustainable investing similarly. It allows you to align your actions with your values. It's about growing your money while also making a positive impact on the world. More and more people, especially younger investors, are eager to vote with their dollars and align their investments with their values. In fact, a recent study found that over 70% of millennials consider environmental, social, and governance factors to be important when making investment decisions. Today, we're joined by a stellar panel of experts to explore how we can make a real impact with our portfolios. This episode is brought to you by my financial advisory firm, Runnymede Capital Management. I want to invite you to do a 3-minute plan that calculates your max retirement income. If you want to see if a financial plan can help you feel more in control of your finances, go visit inspiredmoney.fm/getplan. It just takes a few minutes. You'll get instant feedback. And if you'd like, we can set up a one-on-one call to review it. I'm always happy to point you in the right direction. Okay, let's welcome in our panel of experts. Let me start with, there's Tanzi. I'll start with Tanzi. Tanzi Whalen is a distinguished professor of practice for business and society at NYU Stern. She's founding director of the Center of Sustainable Business. As former president of the Rainforest Alliance, she grew the organization's budget from $4.5 million to $50 million. Her research focuses on ESG investing, sustainable business practices, business ethics, and eco-friendly tourism. Welcome, Tanzi.
Pleasure to be here. Glad to join you all.
I'm so glad that you could make it. Next, we have Charlie Kleisner. He is a pioneer in the impact investing field and co-founder of the KL Felicitas Foundation, Tonic, and Twist. With over 20 years of experience as a senior technology executive in Silicon Valley, Dr. Kleissner advocates for values-driven investing in systemic change, promoting deep impact and sustainable development globally. Welcome, Charlie.
Thanks so much, Andy. I'm glad to be here and look forward to our conversation.
I love that I heard you say that with wealth comes responsibility to make a positive contribution to humanity and the planet. So I look forward to getting into that. And then rounding out our panel, we have Andy Behar. I should say Andrew Behar, because he said, I'll be Andy, and he's going to be Andrew today. Andrew is CEO of As You Sow, a leading nonprofit in shareholder advocacy and engagement, driving values-aligned investing to address issues like climate change, diversity, and wage equity. With a 30-year career spanning documentary filmmaking, entrepreneurial ventures, and patent-holding innovations, he's also a board of advisor for Sustainable Media Center and author of the Shareholders Action Guide. Andrew, so glad that you're here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And with that, we are going to launch our discussion. Let's start with segment one.
Sustainable investing merges financial goals with positive societal impact by incorporating environmental, social, and governance factors. This approach includes socially responsible investing, impact investing, and ESG investing. SRI began in the 1960s, focusing on excluding investments in harmful industries like tobacco and weapons. Over time, it evolved to include positive screening, selecting companies that demonstrate strong ESG performance. Impact investing aims to generate measurable social and environmental benefits along with financial returns. ESG investing involves evaluating companies based on their environmental practices, social responsibilities, and governance standards. This method helps investors identify risks and opportunities that traditional financial analysis might overlook. While SRI focuses on ethical exclusions, ESG integrates sustainability into financial analysis, and impact investing proactively seeks specific positive outcomes. Understanding these approaches allows investors to build portfolios that achieve financial success while contributing to societal well-being.
Charlie, I want to start with you because you and your wife, Lisa, founded KL Felicitas Foundation, your family foundation, and you created a 100% impact portfolio. Can you talk about the evolution from some of the negative screening to where you are today?
Yeah, glad to do that, Andy. So as you mentioned, my wife, Lisa, and I have been in the impact space since over 20 years, since 2002. And so we've seen the evolution and have been playing a role in steering it into a direction where we believe we need to change the underlying systems that drive our economy and our financial systems. Why am I saying that? Well, because if you think about the root causes of the multi-systemic crisis that we're in, then eventually you're going to end up with the economic system design and the financial system design. And there's two deadly design flaws. On the economic side, it's that we are driving our economic system as if we could grow indefinitely, exponentially on a planet that's finitely resourced, that cannot go well long-term, particularly as we approach 9-10 billion people. And the financial system design's deadly design flaw is that it's only about financial returns at the expense of everything else. And so unless we change that, I think we will just return the crisis that we're in. But more disturbingly, we will get deeper into this crisis. And so our objective is to contribute to alleviating the root causes of these systems. And so when I saw the ESG train coming, just briefly commenting on that one, if I may, about 6 years ago, I was concerned about the positioning of ESG as impact and the confusion in the marketplace about this. I think we're working through that. And I think ESG has its place, so has impact. But I think if you want to go deeper, and I just key that up for a potential discussion later, Andy, I'm not going to explore deeper on that right now. But if you actually want to change systems, you know, including the financial system itself, then you need to go beyond the current impact investing craft and challenge yourself about how investments and philanthropic capital and others can contribute to positive systems change. And the last thought that I want to tee up here is that I believe that this change can only be done if we also change our awareness and consciousness so that we as humans take the responsibility that comes with that and our stewardship for the planet and for society. And I'm looking forward to discussing this also because you mentioned Hawaii and ukulele. My wife is part Hawaiian, and the Hawaiians have a beautiful name for that. It's called kuleana. It's the responsibility that comes to take care of your land, aina, and the people. And it's also a privilege, not just a responsibility.
Absolutely. I look forward to, hopefully we can inspire viewers and listeners to change their mindset towards that positive systemic change. Tansi, I want to ask you, because the Center for Sustainable Business helps business leaders to embed sustainability core to business strategies. And your research says that this not only is better for societal performance, but it can lead to better financial performance. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. Be delighted to. And I just want to say also, I fully concur with what Charlie had to say. So what we're seeing is that the conventional approach to corporate behavior, you know, production, consumption, et cetera, is dependent, as Charlie said, on natural resources that are rapidly disappearing, on an outdated understanding of risk, on things like the impacts of climate change, on human and crop productivity, on, you know, transport, on insurance, on everything else, the challenges around not taking care of our people well and exploitation leading to problems for the business as well as for society. So we've been, analyzing what actually are the drivers of better financial performance. We looked first at kind of across the board. We analyzed more than 1,000 academic studies looking at the correlation between financial performance and corporate performance and investor performance between 2020 and 2015. We haven't published this yet, a quick update since. What we found is that 58% of the studies found a strong positive correlation between sustainability and corporate financial performance. And we found that on the investor side, 33% of the studies found that sustainable investing outperformed conventional, 33% found it operated at par. There were definitely studies, I think there was something like 12% of studies or 14% that found a negative correlation on the investor side. There's real challenges with the studies like that, though, which we fully agree with, which is these are correlations, not causality. But then we developed a methodology called ROSI, Return on Sustainability Investment, where we're looking at the causality. And I know we can talk more about that later, but we've identified 9 mediating factors that drive better financial performance when you do embed sustainability core to business strategy, ranging from innovation and growth to operational efficiencies to risk mitigation to employee engagement to supplier resiliency, et cetera. All things which are going, you can improve through better management. But what we're seeing is that sustainability is now a way to really drive better and improved management. How that translates into investing, final point I will make here, is that for investors, right now, most are depending on ESG reporting metrics to do the ESG investing analysis. Those ESG reporting metrics are problematic because they're based on process and output-based metrics. Things like, do you have a policy on X? Have you trained X number of people? None of those things actually drive better performance, either from a societal perspective or a financial perspective. They could, but I have no idea whether a policy on chemical management is actually driving improvements that would result in lower risk, more operational efficiency, and competitive advantage. Whereas an apparel company that's developed a bio-based dye, I can absolutely determine what the financial benefit is. So investors need to get beyond sort of these sort of ESG reporting metrics to look at the underlying thesis around what are the drivers of better financial performance and which companies are better managed and have a sort of competitive moat associated with those improvements that they're making that are really robust in improving the business.
Thank you for that. Andrew, I know that you have looked at a lot of mutual funds and different choices that investors can, or I guess different vehicles that investors can use. Can you talk about that? And maybe like, what are the differences between socially responsible investing, SRI, impact investing, and ESG investing?
Sure. Well, thank you very much. So as you said, as a 501c3, we're a nonprofit. So we do a great deal of research at a company level. We're looking at 3,000 companies on racial justice and DEI across 61 key performance indicators and updating it quarterly. So I take what was said before about ESG data is very, very important that we do our own research, basically. And because a lot of the data that's being put out by the companies is often misleading. There's very little rules or enforcement around companies that and how they communicate with their shareholders in terms of material disclosure. So you got to get to the core of, you know, what's really going on. And the good news is that there's some new metrics that are being developed in Europe, CSRD it's called, and CSDDD, that are being put into going to be rolled out in the next, you know, 6-10 months or so. And what we're going to be seeing is 49,000 European companies and 10,000 US companies are going to be starting to report and disclose in a standardized format. They're going to be required to have third-party verification. And so we're about to come into a whole new era of environmental, social, and governance data that's going to be able to guide shareholders to identify who are the best management teams. Ultimately, when you invest, you're investing in a management team. And the folks who can assess and address risk are going to be the ones you want to overweight in your portfolio, because they're most likely to be able to, like, for instance, look at climate change. And they're going to say, oh, you know, I mean, right now we're seeing what we call climate inflation, that there's no olive oil, for instance, coming out of Southern Europe because of a heat wave. There's no British Columbia just lost their entire vintage of grapes. Cacao, chocolate, price is doubling because of climate. But these heat waves are disrupting the production. So cotton, Pakistan floods, Texas, there's droughts. So the teams who are adjusting, who are assessing the risk, adjusting to the risk, that's the companies who you want to put your money into, as opposed to there's a lot of companies that just say, we're ignoring it, and I can talk about this more later, but there's been a whole anti-ESG crusade that's been very well funded by the oil companies and by this far right group that is making it illegal in some states to assess and address risk. If you can get your head around that, literally those 18 states that have now adopted those laws, all of their pension funds are underperforming. The companies the banks that would be funding municipal bonds in those states, they're no longer allowed to do business in those states because they have a climate transition plan. So all these states are paying more money for their bonds. And so there's this whole attempt to make it political, when really what this is about is just picking the best management teams that are going to be assessing and addressing risk. So I didn't answer your question, but we evaluate 6,000 mutual funds every month on a range of different environmental, social, and governance topics. And we have, it's called investyourvalues.org, open to the public. You can go there, type in any mutual fund or ETF, and you will get a ranking for it. And then we aggregate those up for 401k plans for about 60 companies now. And we will continue to build that out.
Any advice for how an investor can go to that website and choose? Like, how do they choose what best aligns with their values?
Well, basically, you go in there and you literally, there's a pull down menu and you can say, what do I care about? I care about climate change. You have to get at least a B on climate change, and you have to get at least an A on private prisons or gender equality. You can put in whatever grades you want, and then it sorts through 6,000 mutual funds and ETFs, and we'll put the ones at the top that get the better scores. And then you can compare their financial outputs over the last 10 years. So, you know, for instance, if you're looking for a target date fund, you can say, show me the Vanguard, Fidelity, BlackRock, and Natixis, which is a sustainable one, target date fund, a 2050 target date fund. You can see the scores, and you can see the sustainable one is going to be getting better scores, and it happens to also outperform over over the past 5, 2, 3, all of the years, they've outperformed all the other target date funds. So if your company's offering you various target date funds in your 401k plan, you'd say, well, you know what? I actually want to have a livable planet and I want to make more money. I choose that particular one. So it's very simple to use.
A helpful resource.
Yeah.
Okay, with that, let's go to segment two.
To ensure that sustainable investments are both profitable and beneficial to society, it's important to evaluate their impact and performance. This involves using frameworks like the Global Reporting Initiative and the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. These tools help organizations report on their economic, environmental, and social impacts, giving investors a clear picture of how their investments contribute to broader sustainability goals. Impact measurement and management sets clear objectives, collects relevant data, and refines strategies to ensure that both financial and impact goals are met. For instance, companies with high ESG ratings often perform better financially because they manage risks more effectively and innovate more consistently. Investments in renewable energy projects and affordable housing show how impactful investments can deliver strong financial returns while addressing critical social and environmental issues. Investors can build portfolios with a comprehensive approach so investments align with both values and long-term financial goals, fostering informed and responsible decision-making.
Hansi, you mentioned the ROSI methodology, Return on Sustainability Investment. Can you talk about how that bridges sustainability strategies and financial performance?
Sure, absolutely. And I think one thing I would just want to add to the previous conversation that plugs us in here is you talked earlier about the different forms of which one of the confusions for people, I think, is understanding the distinctions between ESG integration, negative screens, impact investing, and they all have different cost, sort of risk return reward profiles as well, right? So impact investing is when you have a very specific investment thesis where you want to be focusing your investments on companies that are actually contributing to societal benefit. So it might be inclusive finance or renewable energy or those types of things. There, often you're talking about startups or smaller companies, innovations, and you may have a higher risk profile, but you may also have a higher reward profile if the company does well, right? So understanding that is, and sort of getting to know, just like you would with anything else, AI, tech, whatever, understanding what the underlying drivers are, whether it's regulation, challenges, market demand, et cetera, will help you assess, the different ways you can invest there. On the ESG integration and negative screen side of things. So negative screen is, as you mentioned in one of your videos, like I don't want weapons, I don't want X, Y, or Z. The ESG integration, this is something that investors need to understand. It's all over the map what that means when companies say this is an ESG fund. It can be they've just looked at the ESG metrics and like assessed whether anything provides a risk, but they don't actually make any investment decisions particularly based on it. They don't necessarily vote based on it at your proxies. It might be that they're saying, we're just going to take the top, 20% performers on ESG metrics, and we're going to, do a diversified portfolio otherwise, and we're just going to do that. Or they might say, we're going to take the laggards of the 50% mark who've made a commitment because we believe that as they improve, that will unlock better financial performance. Whole series of different ways you can think about it. And the investors really need to understand the underlying strategy, right? The challenges that I see with the ESG strategies tie back to what I raised earlier, which is ESG reporting metrics like SASB and GRI are process-based metrics and risk-based. So we looked at SASB, it's 70% activities and outputs. In other words, things like, do you have a policy? Have you actually just, do you have some type of way you talk about chemicals or whatever, right? They're not actual outcomes of actual change. And so using those to determine investment strategies, I think, is problematic. The CSRD, which was mentioned earlier, also has a very process-oriented focus. I think having harmonization of this data is really useful. We need to have it. But savvy investors need to understand the underlying value drivers of better sustainability performance. And this is now I'm talking about companies that are not in the business of a direct societal output, but a food company or a manufacturing company of some type, right? And there, the ROSI analysis sort of, and again, we're working on this with private equity and other, and also with banks and so on, to understand, all right, if in the automotive sector, sustainability drives operational efficiency, innovation and growth, and reduction of risk, which companies are doing circular strategies? Like we saw one company that was reusing 2.5% of used car components and recycling 10%, paying to dispose of the rest. So they were netting $100 million. That circular strategy of putting old product back into new product saves you money. Also improves resiliency. I used to sit on a car company board, and during that, we've been struggling with global supply chains. If you are actually reusing product, you have less risk in your global supply chain because you're actually able to bring more in-house. There's these kinds of benefits, right? So while any individual investor doesn't need to be a specialist in every single value driver in every single industry, they cannot be. Understanding that these underlying drivers of better financial performance are far more important for the fund managers to understand and use to drive their investment decisions than the ESG reporting data, which is a useful input, but shouldn't be the sole way to drive kind of portfolio construction.
What are the sources for that data that investment managers can use?
Yeah, so here's the problem, and this is fascinating and concerning and will begin to change. Virtually no company today is tracking the financial returns on their sustainability investment. And to show you the problem with reporting, so with CSRD, what I'm hearing from company after company is, yes, we're going to have to ramp up our investments in compliance and reporting. So therefore, we're going to put less money into strategy and execution. In what world can you report on something for which you have done nothing? Only in a world where your ESG reporting metrics are on process and outputs, not on actual performance. So I think this is a huge challenge that we need to get investors to understand, that we need to be seeing investments in ways that are going to drive better financial performance. Otherwise, we're going to put in place all this regulatory apparatus with no benefit to the companies, no benefit to the investors.
Andrew, I'm curious, since you mentioned standardization with CSRD and CSDDD, is that a good solution? And what metrics do you find actually are the most helpful?
So right now, it's just the Wild West. Right now, there's really no structure other than what companies are outputting and what nonprofits are, you know, what analysts are figuring out for themselves. You know, SASB is a good start, but even there, you know, the definitions of materiality have in large part been constructed by the companies and by industry. And the definition of materiality is purely what information investors need to make a buy or sell decision. So we're moving into a new world that I'm very optimistic about. Also, you know, the SEC just came out with new rules on how you can name mutual funds. Just a few years ago, as you saw, we ran a study. We looked at 90 mutual funds with ESG in their name, and 60 of them got Ds or Fs on ESG from us. And we brought that to the SEC, and that's part of the reason that, you know, this whole new fund naming rule has just been approved. It's going into effect. And there's a similar one. It's a little bit better in Europe, under ESMA, where they actually can define what is a sustainable fund, what is a transition fund. So right now, people are investing in a basket of stocks and they have no idea what they're getting. There's 100 million people with $10 trillion that literally are investing in their own destruction. They are investing massively. I mean, like the Amazon, the Amazon 401k plan, like, yeah, Amazon's building 100,000 electric vehicles, but everybody at Amazon owns companies burning down the Amazon. They just don't know it because it's so well hidden. So we're going to have a lot more transparency in the next couple of years, which is going to, I think, be this new era of ESG. Now, in terms of the actual data, I can tell you, like, as you saw, we looked at looked at 1,500 companies across 5 years. We looked at their what are called EEO1 reports, that's workplace diversity. So looked at about 1.5 million data points, and we found a correlation of companies with greater diversity outperformed on 8 key financial metrics. So we know, we feel very strongly that when we go and talk to companies, because that's what AsUSO does, we engage hundreds of companies every year on how do you improve your policies and practices. We're best known for filing shareholder resolutions. We filed 99 last year, which is an escalation of that, those conversations. And we sit down with companies, go, look, do you want to be more competitive? Look at your competition, look what they're doing, and look at how they are outperforming because of this. And most companies, they look at it and go, thank you. You guys are like McKinsey for free, and start the process of transforming into a better business plan. So we're more on a, like our mission is to really help each of these companies to improve. So we do the same thing with climate. We do the same thing with toxins in the food system, racial justice, DEI, et cetera. So the data, I agree, is in a, we're moving into a very new space right now. And it's not perfect, but it's getting better. And there's, I think one indication is there's this massive, an intense pushback against it. Like I said, making assessing and addressing risk illegal, like literally illegal in 18 states. The folks who don't want you to look at risk are terrified. And they're saying, not only don't look at risk, which makes me want to look at risk even more, but they're making it illegal to look at risk, which makes it imperative to look at risk. So I think we're on the path toward, but there's a much bigger macroeconomic thing happening here. I mean, the ideas of Milton Friedman have been shown, they failed. And in 2019, 181 companies agreed to a whole new purpose of a corporation that's based on taking care of your employees, taking care of your customers and your supply chain and the communities where you operate. There's the ideas of Joseph Stiglitz. He put out a new book called The Road to Freedom. It's basically, saying the ideas of Milton Friedman, just literally we had 50 years of showing that those ideas were based on false assumptions and most of the global economy is based on these ideas. So we're in a transformation, the scale of the Industrial Revolution right now. We are moving toward a regenerative economy based on justice and sustainability. And we need all of these metrics. We need true transparency to achieve it.
I don't know if this is true, but somebody once told me that screening individual companies for ESG metrics, the example that I was given was that ExxonMobil ranked better than Tesla. I don't know if that's accurate.
I can tell you why. Because Tesla refuses to disclose at all. Like they are very, they just literally, I mean, we did a report on water and every car company in the world. Now, Tesla just is the only company that said, we're not giving you any data. So how do you score them? You just say they get a zero. And everybody else, they could have improvements. And what do you do? So Tesla's just very arrogant. And I know, Elon Musk says, these ESG, these scores, they're all skewed. Well, he is personally trying to make them skewed. If Tesla would report, they probably would be number one. But they've chosen to, be just incredibly arrogant. And he continues to, try to alienate all the Tesla customers and harm the company. I don't know why Tesla, I don't know why people don't vote him out or put in a new board that would replace him, because he's just destructive to the company at this point.
Hmm. Charlie, I hear that there are many complexities here to the extent where one can be like paralysis by analysis, not being able to move forward. You're obviously a very action-oriented person. So tell viewers, how do you look past this Wild West scenario to actually act upon and do what you want to achieve?
Right. Thank you. And I think the points that were made before are very accurate, Andrew and Tenzi. Well, when we work with Tonic members and outside of Tonic, with families and friends and wealthy individuals on helping them transform their portfolios to 100% impact portfolios, there's usually four stages that people go through. The first one, well, the prerequisite is actually that you reflect on your values as a family, as an investor. What do you stand for, right? And once you articulate that, then most people don't want to forget about that when it comes to their investment strategies. And so you can then detoxify as the first step your portfolio with things that are counter to your values, because that allows you to sleep again, right? Because if you have values, you want to make sure that you don't knowingly counter that. Once you have detoxified your portfolio, then you can go into ESG, maybe ESG Plus on the public side of your portfolios. There's a ton of products out there. Albeit a lot of brainwashing going on, and we can dive into that. So pay attention to this. And then most people then that are sincere about impact, they want to go deeper with part of their portfolio into the impact themes that they choose are important to them. And that's where it's important to collaborate with others, join some networks, or learn with others to figure out, you know, what in your themes you can invest in with an appropriate risk. And that's then maybe the most adventurous impact investors then carve out a part of their portfolio to not apply financial metrics anymore, because the modern portfolio theory doesn't hold for deep impact, because a lot of the themes that you might work on, there's no market for it. And so what does market rate return actually means? And so most impact investors then, for that portion of their portfolio, work on an absolute return strategy and say, well, I'm interested in going very, very deep in these types of themes. And I expect on over that portion of my portfolio, you know, an absolute return of this pain, whatever it is, right? And then you, that leads you to investments with the appropriate risk. I mean, you know, Andy, I have started, I think, the 100% impact movement, what, about 12, 13 years ago, and within the Atomic community first, with the assumption that if we can actually prove that we can have 100% portfolio and it has competitive financial risks, I mean, competitive financial returns as expressed by the risk return analysis on asset classes, and go as deep as possible on the impact side, that maybe we have a lot of copycatters. And Lisa and I embarked on that in 2004. In 2007, we started moving in aggressively 100%. And then in 2018, we published our report looking back at 10-year financial performance. And indeed, across all asset classes, we were able to show that we had the competitive financial performance, while about half of our portfolio went 50% into what the IMP terminology calls contributions to solutions, and the rest in ESG++ and what have you. And so we wrote a report about this in order to inspire others, you know, to document our impact management strategies, which is the bigger topic that we're talking about, articulating our theory of transformation that Andrew articulated quite nicely, that we're in this bigger transformation stage and that we need to change the systems. And our theory of change is that we will contribute to that by investing in the first social impact bond, for instance, which explicitly ties the financial return to a proven negative or positive impact, by investing in the first social stock exchanges, by investing in venture capital structures, by investing in first-time managers that are not, you know, by investing in DEI and themes that are quite difficult to invest in. Sometimes it's getting better now. And measuring the outcomes and the outputs using SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals terminology, IMP, Impact Management Project terminology, IRIS Plus terminology, so people can read up on that, on this, and can copy and paste. Yet, you know, maybe end on that, on the challenge again. You know, most advisors today operate out of you know, what's called modern portfolio theory, advising their clients mostly on risk and return related issues on the financial side. Because there's no integrated postmodern portfolio theory where the impact, risk, and return is totally integrated into the theory, not as an add-on like the CSR, so that we can actually talk about causality, you know, between the financial risk and return and the impact risk and return. And I wish that more people would work on that and would publish data sets that actually show what we can accomplish. And I started the T100 project with Donic, and now work with MIT on systemic change and how to measure that, what are leading indicators for investors and philanthropists to see if they're actually making a change in more complex systems where you have to take into account negative and positive feedback loops and the emergence of things as well. And those are not embraced yet. Those methodologies we need to co-invent in order to solve for the SDGs. It's not just throwing money at it. It's all systemic issues that need to be regulated, where philanthropy and many more things need to happen as opposed to just throwing money at it. So maybe just stop here, because I don't know where you want to go, Andy or somebody else on that topic.
I'd love to comment on, you bring up modern portfolio theory many times, just so people understand what that is. That was developed in 1952, before we had computers really being used for, you know, financial investing. The idea that you have to have 8% of your portfolio in energy and 7% in this and this and this is just so outdated. It's unbelievable. I mean, there have been so many studies that have shown that you can take an index, like take 1,000 companies, and you could literally remove the entire energy sector, rebalance it, and you could have zero tracking error, which means you'd be making exactly what the benchmark's making. You literally can, there's just so many more advanced tools now. And so this idea of, we look at modern portfolio theory and we say, this is part of the problem, is just people are still, and in Wall Street, they've been trained in this way, but that they really need to think more of universal ownership. That when you own the entire economy, then, and there's five or six companies that are causing harm to the rest of the portfolio, then, well, as you said, we do shareholder advocacy. So we believe as in shareholders, you need to engage those six companies to get them to stop harming everything else. So it's a whole different philosophy of investing that really needs to be understood, and that modern portfolio theory is just simply not modern at all.
Well said. With that, let's go to segment three.
Sustainable investing faces challenges such as data availability, greenwashing, and active shareholder engagement. The lack of standardized, reliable ESG data complicates comparisons across companies. Organizations like SASB and GRI are working to standardize ESG reporting. Greenwashing, where companies falsely claim sustainability, is a significant risk. To combat this, investors must conduct thorough due diligence, looking beyond marketing materials to analyze actual ESG performance. Third-party ESG ratings and reports can offer a more accurate assessment. Active shareholder engagement is important. Divesting from unsustainable companies is common, but effective change often comes from active ownership strategies, like voting on resolutions and engaging in dialogue with management. Collaborating with other investors can amplify influence. Balancing financial and impact goals is essential. Well-managed ESG investments can provide competitive returns and reduce long-term risks. Integrating ESG factors into financial analysis helps achieve both financial and impact objectives, ensuring investments contribute to a sustainable future while delivering solid returns.
Hansi, you accurately said that individuals cannot be expected to know everything. What strategies do you recommend for investors to identify and avoid greenwashing in potential investments?
Well, so first of all, if they're working with asset managers or ETFs in the public market space, they should understand how that particular ETF is constructed, what kind of expertise the asset manager has in ESG. Most typically, a lot of those funds just buy ESG data rankings from the raters. And you mentioned before Elon Musk's, you know, he had a hissy fit because he got kicked off of the S&P index, I think. What we see is when academic studies have looked at the rating agencies, and they all will rate each company completely differently. And that's partially because the ESG data is challenging at the moment, but also because each of them have their own black box sort of way they approach it. It's a lot, much longer conversation. But you can't really rely, you can use that as sort of an input, but you cannot rely on those ratings. So what you really need is people at the bank or the institution who's created that to really have expertise in those topics. So that's one thing, is you want to ask the questions. What's your background on these topics? How do you how do you assess the sustainability of the companies that you're investing in? Certainly, as you saw, provides good feedback. Certainly, Morningstar assessment, you know, there are these assessments that you can look at that will help you. And I'm not saying that, you know, you should ignore the ESG data rankings, but that they should just be one input into it. I think, you know, a company like, I'm going to name check Brown Sustainable Advisory Growth Fund. I think that the way they approach it is interesting because rather than just saying, I'm just going to do this based on some ESG data, they have a kind of theory of change, a way in which they're thinking about how sustainability drives competitive advantage. So is this particular company, have they developed a product or service that's tackling a particular environmental or social challenge? Are they employing processes, let's say they're a manufacturing company, that reduces their use of natural resources and therefore their impact and also improves operational efficiency? Do they have a unique technology that's going to be solving for a particular challenge? So they're looking at much more strategically what is driving potential or existing outperformance. The other thing that I want to add, and this goes back to what Charlie was saying around, you know, understanding some of the underlying issues, right? So, and how little I think currently asset managers understand these things. I'm going to talk about the social side for a minute because I think a lot of people care about workers and how they're treated in companies. And a lot of information shows that companies that treat their workers well actually outperform, right? But what we see is, let's look at the retail sector. They have 150 to 200% turnover in those sectors. They justify that by saying, hey, you know, our margins are great because we're only paying our people $6 an hour. Let's look at Domino's. Domino's has to hire 180,000 people to fill 134,000 slots each year. So the amount of time, effort, and money spent to hire 180,000 people every year, they train that person. It takes a month for that person to become productive and be able to handle the things that Domino wants them to do. All of Domino's people, or most of them, leave after a month. Customer satisfaction is so low that Domino's offers free pizzas if you're annoyed at Domino's. When they're reporting their financials and when they're evaluating that company, they're only reporting on the fact that our labor costs are really low. We're paying $6 an hour. They're not reporting on the cost of all of that turnover. They're not reporting on the cost of the free pizzas, et cetera, right? So these types of underlying, like this goes back to that's the Milton Friedman approach, right? But the Milton Friedman approach actually I don't know if it ever worked, but it doesn't work now. And I think investors need to be understanding to a general degree those underlying challenges and be asking their asset managers, their fund holders, are you understanding and what is your background in understanding these sets of drivers of better financial performance and better impact?
Free pizza. Now you're talking my language. Andrew, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, like the Milton Friedman approach back in the 1970s. And one of the things that his approach is, it's about externalizing your costs, dump in the commons, abuse your employees and have employee turnover, but pay them as little as possible. Poison your customers, it's okay. Like that just does not work anymore, particularly like dumping in the commons, dumping your carbon in the atmosphere has now created climate change that has now come back and is biting the companies, you know, in the back because the global supply chains for all the commodities they need, the raw supplies, are being reduced because of it. So it's that whole attitude of, yeah, we'll put that off of our balance sheets. So you think about it, the solution is actually just stop all subsidies, that externalizing your costs, polluting in the commons, is a subsidy because somebody has to pay for it. If you have a coal plant and kids are getting asthma, society is paying for those kids going to the emergency room. If the companies that generated the problem actually had to pay for the solution and it was priced into their products, you'd have very different models. You would have, you know, oil would be at a price, gasoline at the pumps, where, well, electric vehicles are already much cheaper and much better. And renewables are obviously under, It costs much less to get a kilowatt of electricity with renewables than with, you know, a commodity-based combustion product. So, like, this is the transformation is, the markets have already shifted is the bottom line here. The markets have spoken. The invisible hand of the markets already is done. And the resistance to try to slow down using the heavy hand of big government. It's interesting that it's Republicans who are using big government to try to slow down the transformation of the free market. It's just counter to the whole, you know, their whole philosophy. But in terms of good data, I just wanted to say, we actually spun off a for-profit company called As You Know that's aggregating up high-quality ESG data and licensing it into the commercial marketplace. And then the license fees we get, we're distributing back down to the nonprofits, the folks who create the data, because data maintenance is really the issue within As You Sow. Like our racial justice and DEI data, we update that once a quarter. The reason we can do that is because folks are licensing it, creating racial justice, separately managed accounts and ETFs and things. And then we get a share of that profit. We can hire researchers. So now the data gets better. And so now it's trying to share that model with all the other nonprofits, and they're putting their data into our system. We're creating a marketplace, and then we just have a totally transparent sharing system. So better data from the folks who are gathering the data are actually doing it with the intent of helping the company with advocacy, as opposed to the company putting out the data, which then, you know, Sustainalytics and MSCI, they scrape up all this data. They put their brand on it and go, well, now it must be true because it's in a database, and it's not. So again, we're moving toward into a place of better, higher quality data. And ultimately, transparency is about trust. Transparency is, I mean, the fundamentals of the SEC climate disclosure rule. When a company discloses information, if it's accurate, verified by a third party in a standardized format, that creates trust with your shareholders. And it's about time horizon also. Milton Friedman's very much like the next quarter. The ideas of Joseph Stiglitz and the idea of stakeholder capitalism is long-term sustainable growth. When you start looking at longer term and that time horizon goes longer, it's beneficial for everybody. It's beneficial for the entire cycle, for the companies, for the employees, for their customers.
That was great. Charlie, did you want to comment your due diligence process with greenwashing?
Yeah, maybe just quickly. I believe we are far off from peak impact washing. I think it's going to increase, not decrease, and therefore smart regulation is important, and impact investors demanding net positive impact measurements and management, including the negative impact, is important. Introducing impact-linked compensation for intermediaries is important so that they are compensated for their services, the more positive impact, net positive impact they provide. And even that, in my opinion, is not sufficient. I just wanted to bring up ethical standards and ethical obligations by what I believe the market leaders of tomorrow will be. If you think about the fiascos around CO2 offsets, right, where so many people, both consumers and companies, want to offset their CO2 emissions, particularly if they're on a path to really lowering it. I think it's a great transformation. I'm in transition way of doing things, but it shouldn't be used, you know, as a band-aid for you to continue your bad behavior. And so the ethical standards around that are quite deep and difficult, right? And so I believe that if we go back to the resiliency of regional systems and the insights of indigenous wisdom traditions, you know, selling CO2 offsets from regional landowners to regional businesses, and people can visit that and can visit the structures of the forest and what have you, and the biodiversity that comes with it, is along the lines of reintroducing indigenous principles to the modern world, and then enabling you know, not just verification, but going beyond verification and the stick to carrots and incentivizing that behavior. And we can use technology, maybe that's the next one of the next topics if we have time to explore that, you know, can help in that. And so I do believe that the companies of the future will go beyond regulation, the successful companies, and actually self-regulate with ethical standards that are important for making humanity and the planet a regenerative place, as Andrew pointed out before.
That's a perfect segue. We are going to talk technology. Let's go to segment 4.
Technological advancements are transforming sustainable investing, making it easier to incorporate ESG criteria into investment decisions. Big data analytics process vast amounts of information swiftly, identifying trends and risks, and enabling real-time ESG metric tracking for precise decisions. Artificial intelligence enhances ESG analysis by processing complex data sets quickly, providing comprehensive assessments of companies' ESG performance and risks. AI also automates the collection, analysis, and reporting of ESG data, improving accuracy and efficiency while streamlining workflows. Digital platforms powered by AI and big data democratize sustainable investing, offering accessible interfaces and educational resources. These platforms enable a wider range of investors to participate in sustainable investing, driving more capital toward projects that address global environmental and social challenges. By leveraging these technologies, investors can make informed decisions that align with their financial goals and contribute to a sustainable future. This tech-driven approach enhances transparency, efficiency, and access in sustainable investing.
Charlie, I want to go back to you since you're the technologist. Can artificial intelligence and big data help to transform our current extractive system into a regenerative one?
Deep tech can certainly play a role, but subservient to actually the impact that we want to accomplish and not driving it. And so we see lots of great applications of AI in successful social entrepreneurs in the health environment field. Also in education, where they use AI in order to be able to target parts of the population that otherwise they could not target with the way that actually speaks to them. And that's a positive development. I think on the challenging side, I think the overall design of the current large language models, the current AI structures, are not only wasting a lot of energy, which will be taken care of over time, but the bigger problem is what they scrape, what they base their analysis on. And that's obviously from the existing internet. And the existing internet is driven 92% by content that's driven by the white populations of the global north. And so the insights that these algorithms then gain from that data set are hugely biased towards that demography. And it's like a mirror of the consciousness that we have developed in the global north. And when you ask the Metas and the Googles and the Facebooks, the research bosses of AI, do they have a responsibility to contribute to, over time, developing comprehensive data sets that include the marginalized, that include the global south, that include the spiritual nature, that include indigenous populations? They will say no, normally, right? They don't see it. So who owns that responsibility? It scares me because, it would have to be anchored at the UN level because it's a really big, big issue. And the echo chambers are just going to increase and not decrease. So I wonder, what we could do on that level, working with the World Economic Forum and other forums, to figure out if we have some leverage points to actually counter that darker side of AI. And I'm personally, of course, invested in some of these startups in order to move, let's say, the impact management field forward. And I think tokenization of impact is a great field to invest in. And it's regulatory challenging still. You can only do it in Singapore and in Switzerland right now. But still, we need to experiment with that. And for the impact that can be digitalized, if we can develop marketplaces that are tokenized and then are related to the real economy, well, that would be the holy grail for some of these technologies to come to the market. The problem there is that today nobody wants to pay for impact insights. You cannot make a business model work on that yet. And yet, I do believe that with the topic of maybe scarce resources, that will be the markets that pop early. I was very critical earlier on in my remarks about CO2 offset markets. And I mean that, but if we design them, you know, accurately and with including of the marginalized and the beneficiaries and the disadvantaged, then they could actually work. And I think that that technology will help us move forward in subservient to being human. So the current rhetoric by some of the titans of AI confusing consciousness with algorithms is not even naive at best. It's just that it does a disservice to humanity.
Yeah, very interesting insights on the weaknesses of AI. Andrew, any thoughts on applying AI to the data sets and research that you're doing?
It's helpful in some sense, but it's also does a lot of, we've done testing it a bunch. It does a lot of hallucinating. It like makes up a lot of information that we've come to not trust it. So, you know, maybe if we're doing some research, it might lead us in down some paths. But in terms of the research that we do, we really need to have humans reading annual reports, you know, corporate social responsibility reports, meeting with and interviewing the folks at the companies and really seeing what they are doing, because it comes down to really personal relationships and long-term relationships, and to understand what's the company's philosophy, and then are they actually implementing it? Because a lot of times, you know, like the company I mentioned, like Amazon's 401k plan, they have a philosophy. They're getting 100,000 electric vehicles, but everybody who works there as a 401k plan burning down the Amazon. All of the cash that they have is invested in climate destruction. It's because it's in, you know, your basic standard portfolios. So they don't apply their philosophies holistically. That's why there's this cognitive dissonance around so many companies, because yeah, they put out great statements, but then they don't apply them to everything. You know, it's interesting. I mean, even universities, we meet with a lot of sustainability folks at universities. Yeah, they're putting up solar on the dorms, but the 403b plan is invested in exactly the opposite of the philosophy of the university. Where their cash is being invested is exactly the opposite of their philosophy. So I don't know that AI is going to solve that, but also AI is creating a lot of problems. We engage with, for instance, Meta, and we now have a shareholder relationship. I mean, we've filed shareholder resolutions there about misinformation, disinformation, child pornography, sex trafficking. They know how to solve all these things. I mean, we know the engineers there. They literally could create an algorithm to get rid of sex trafficking on Meta, which is the center for sex trafficking for the whole world, not to mention the place where lynch mobs can organize. They can get rid of that, but they choose not to. And ultimately, that's a Mark Zuckerberg call, because he has a 10-to-1 voting preference. So even if every other shareholder wanted them to do it, which we do, he can say, no, I like that. That's making us money. And so you have this authoritarian regime there that is now using AI and going to be continuing with the misinformation, disinformation, attacks on democracy. And so we think this is really problematic. And then the third piece is the amount of computing power it takes to do AI. We have gotten estimates that the cost of data centers in terms of energy, which is going to have an impact on climate change and carbon, is going to be going up. It's going to be tripling, what is it, like 5x in the next 3 years. So we're talking about massive data centers that are going to make the Bitcoin data centers look tiny by comparison, are all being built right now. And, you know, some groups are, yes, they're going to be offsetting, you know, they're going to be building out a lot of renewables to power them. But, you know, right now, Google's supposedly at about 120% of renewable energy for their data center use, but they're not going to be able to keep up with it. So a lot of new of fossil gas is going to have to be deployed just to keep all those data centers running. So AI's got a lot of problems associated with it.
Tansi, my apologies. I know you're tight on time. Any comments on this topic?
I would just support everything that was said and just say garbage in, garbage out. So until we handle what the garbage in is, and until we handle the kind of energy challenges and some of the other ones recognize, we need to approach this very, very carefully and not see it as a panacea or a way to really drive better impact-oriented investment results.
Thank you. Let's bring it home with our final segment.
The future of sustainable investing is bright, driven by innovations like green bonds, renewable energy, and sustainable agriculture. Green bonds are growing, financing projects such as renewable energy and pollution prevention. Investments in renewable energy are surging, with significant growth in solar, wind, and hydrogen projects led by companies like First Solar and Opal Fuels. Sustainable agriculture is also gaining momentum, with investors supporting organic farming, agroforestry, and regenerative practices that boost soil health and biodiversity. Regulatory changes are enhancing transparency in sustainability reporting. The EU's Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation and the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive set new standards for corporate disclosure. Global climate agreements like the Paris Agreement continue to shape investment trends by promoting ambitious climate goals. Emerging technologies like AI are improving ESG data analysis, offering deeper insights into sustainability performance. Staying informed about these trends helps investors align their portfolios with sustainability goals and seize new opportunities.
Tansy, I think you've got about a minute to spare. What emerging trends in sustainable investing do you think will shape the future of this industry?
I think, first of all, a growing recognition that these sustainability risks, but also opportunities, are driving real benefit and excitement around investment strategy. We heard for millennials, for example, but also I would say for all generations, money is going to women, it's going to millennials. I think there's a strong focus, and I know there's a strong focus and interest there. I think that the we will see more sophistication around analyzing how companies are doing on these topics, more sophistication on what constitute impact, because I want to stress again, ESG reporting metrics are not the same thing as impact key performance indicators, understanding how you're having impact. So I would say, you know, just going back to your, and just to finalize here to your question about what should be investors be looking for as they look ahead and want to build out a more sustainable portfolio, in addition to all the great advice being offered earlier, as you look at let's just say you're looking at it a company perspective, or you're asking your asset manager how they're looking at it, the company should have clear targets that are benchmarked against international standards. They should be reporting annually and transparently on their progress against those standards. They should have a board governance structure. I've been doing research into Fortune 100 board members and their lack of ESG credentials. So does the board have a governance structure and people understand these issues? Is ESG, or the sort of meeting these impact KPIs, built into the compensation in that company? Is there capital allocation that supports investment sustainability? One of the things we're seeing about all these net zero commitments by companies that are leading to greenwashing and to investors not getting what they expected to get is that the companies aren't putting the right capital behind actually being able to make the investments to meet their commitments. I would say as well that investors should feel free and should pressure their asset managers, whom they're working with, to be much more rigorous and transparent about how they're making assessments of these companies and making sure they're looking at these sets of issues. And then finally, I would say, sort of looking forward, I think that increasingly, companies will begin to look not only at the risk side, but the opportunity side. What human nature gets driven by opportunity less than risk. Risk is important, but the upside, being able to create new things, be able to create growth, et cetera, is what actually drives investment and excitement. And so I think that is going to be an important part of engaging people around sustainable investing moving forward.
Yeah, so focus on the opportunity.
Yes.
Thank you, Tansy. Charlie, can you talk about the Twist community and emerging trends in impact investing for systems change?
Yeah, absolutely. And before I do that, just wanted to say again that ESG is better than non-ESG, but if all the money in the world would go into ESG right now, the inequality would increase, the social injustice would increase, and we would not solve or mitigate climate change. in time. And that's why it's so important to augment ESG with a systemic lens approach. And since that's kind of a new approach for investors as opposed to philanthropists, 2 years ago, I thought it would be important to create an organization that we call TWIST now, which stands for Together We Invest for Systems Transformation, for investors to share on how they go about investing in systems change. And we collaborated and co-created the data intake process with MIT, having a template that the researchers then can use to falsify or verify hypotheses of what constitutes system change and how do we measure progress on that. And we are now, we have 44 use cases going to 100 plus. And as soon as we have 100 plus in the next few months, we have a benchmark that we can move forward. Then it's a longitudinal study to then compare notes of different types of system change. Is it place-based or not? Is it across themes or not? Is it changing a small portion of the system or not? What role does the investor play? So those are all the those are among the questions, you know, that we explore. And I think, you know, one good terminology, maybe leave the listeners with that, is the horizon model for systems change. There's a horizon one, which is triaging the existing system so that it doesn't collapse uncontrollably, right? Horizon one. Horizon three is when we have changed the system so that it actually serves humanity and everybody. And horizon two is in between transformation, transition technologies, transition products, transition approaches to reach that. I would say that ESG is triaging the dying system in horizon one. And then, you know, in impact banks and tokenization is actually transition technologies that we're working on right now. And who knows what the ultimate financial system will look like when we figured out how to make it regenerative for humanity and the planet. You know, but we need to experiment now. And which brings me to the very last statement that I want to make, is because all of these ideas, you know, that I'm certainly intrigued by, and many others are, can only be implemented, I think, by working on our own mindset, by shifting our mindset to go back to what I started in the beginning of our conversation, to say, what is the responsibility of being human actually mean? And in my opinion, like I said, like in the Hawaiian opinion and other indigenous people's opinions as well, it brings the responsibility. We're not just here in, you know, to lead a good life. We're here to make a contribution in the evolutionary sense of humanity and to move it forward. And in that sense, you know, I want to conclude my remarks with, not only do we have the responsibility, but then it becomes a privilege to actually do that. And I hope that in my lifetime that we will be able to move that transition forward with the emergence of so many beautiful efforts going on. I'm doubtful that it can happen top down with regulatory sticks and all that in and by itself. So I invite everybody to lead their lives accordingly and invest accordingly, as if the future actually mattered, as opposed to just maximizing your return. Thanks.
Thank you, Charlie. You're a living example of trying to do the right things and making a difference. Andrew, you had a follow-up comment?
I just thank you, Charlie. I think what you're saying is absolutely spot on, and that we are in this amazing transformation. It's really a pretty amazing to be alive right now, where we actually, the actions we take on a daily basis will have an impact on finding this glide path into this a regenerative economy based on justice and sustainability. You know, in the video prior, you're talking about regenerative agriculture, just as a model, the idea that when you harvest your food, the soil is even richer and ready to grow more abundance. I mean, you think about it, we're transforming the entire energy system of the planet. We can absolutely power this entire planet just with renewables. It is absolutely doable. It's just a decision that we need to make. We can actually shift from industrial agriculture to a regenerative agriculture that's going to, each acre will be more productive. The soil will hold water, it will hold carbon, and the farmers will be not exposed to pesticides. We literally could eliminate fossil fuels, eliminate pesticides, and have more food. I mean, you could, I mentioned eliminating subsidies. If you stop paying the oil companies as well as the subsidies of externalizing their costs, you would have enough money to create renewables that could be 300% of what the world needs. And the other 200% could be used for desalination and for pulling water out of the atmosphere, atmospheric water generation, and make power and make clean water a human right for free for everyone on the planet. I mean, these are all absolutely doable with the technology we have today. And yet everybody, you know, I talk to people and they're like, it's impossible. It's like, no, it's just, it's literally just like a decision to not let the current status quo, the oil companies that are controlling our decision-making processes, our governments, to, they have that, they are trying to slow this down because they see it also. That is what the markets are going toward. So I have amazing optimism, and Charlie, you are an inspiration, that we can actually find that path. I really believe that.
Thank you, Andrew. Andrew, what is the URL of the resource that you have that investors can use to search for mutual funds and ETFs?
Sure. Well, you can, if you go to asyousow.org and you just scroll down a tiny bit, you'll see Invest Your Values on the right. It's got a big Invest Your Values. You just click there and then you can type in any stock ticker, a ticker for a mutual fund. You can also go to investyourvalues.org. It stands alone. That's a little bit more complex because it does a whole analysis of 401k plans, but it also has access into the whole suite of tools because there's fossil-free funds, deforestation-free funds, prisons, weapons, gender, et cetera. And we're actually building a new one called Social Justice Funds that we'll have, we're scheduled to have it done by July of 2025, which will pull in racial justice, DEI, LGBTQ, and gender. So we'll be evaluating, you know, 6,000 mutual funds on social issues as well.
Well, I want to thank all the viewers and listeners for joining today. I want to thank the panelists for spending their time with us and sharing their valuable insights. For me, it's been a fantastic hour plus spent together. And my takeaways are that, like, it's all about hope and optimism. That's like a huge theme that I heard throughout. And if I can call for like a homework assignment for the viewers, a call to action, if you will, for your homework, take a moment to review your current investment portfolio, look at the companies and funds that you're invested in, and consider how they align with what's important to you. That's the other thing that we heard a lot about today, whether it's corporate governance or environment, sustainability, LGBTQ. There are so many different, everybody has different values and different things that are important to you individually. So you can use the resource investyourvalues.org, or you can go to asyousow.org and click on Invest Your Values. Just remember that even small changes can make a big difference in aligning your investments with your beliefs. So I encourage everybody to follow today's guest panelist, Tanzi Whalen. You can find her at stern.nyu.edu. Charlie Kleisner is at charliekleisner.com. He's at impactassets.org. He has many URLs. Any other websites you want to send people to, Charlie?
Maybe the Tonic one, if you're interested, tonic.com.
Okay, Tonic. And then Andrew Behar, you can find him at asyousow.org. Thank you, everybody. Once again, thanks to the panelists. I really appreciate you. It's been an enlightening episode. Next week, Inspired Money, we will discuss the gig economy thriving in the new world of work. We're shooting for Wednesday, August 7th at 1 p.m. Eastern. I hope to see you then. Until next time, do something that scares you, because that's where the magic happens. Thanks, everyone.